I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. According to the Centers for Disease Control, upwards of 300 new cases of Lyme disease are reported each year. Lyme disease cases are concentrated in the Northeast and Upper Midwest, with 14 states accounting for over 96% of cases reported to the CDC. 2017 statistics from the State Department of Public Health find Dukes County leading the state in Lyme disease per 100,000 population, followed by Berkshire and Plymouth counties. Nantucket came in fourth on the list, Bristol County fifth, and Barnstable County sixth. Lyme disease isn't the only disease transmitted by the bite of a black-legged tick. We'll talk about that today. We discuss Lyme disease diagnosis, treatment, and prevention. But first, the story of a Chatham woman who contracted Lyme disease and some details about the bacteria that makes humans ill. Here's independent producer Robin Miniter.
Each case of Lyme starts with a tick sitting quietly on a tree or a blade of grass. They do this thing called questing. They stick their legs up in the air and they wait. Chatham resident Ryan McIntyre found a tick on her head a few years ago.
I totally felt one. I embedded in my scalp.
She dug it out. She was fine for a while, until she wasn't.
It wasn't until I was studying abroad that I really knew for a fact something bigger was wrong.
Weird things began to happen in her body. She had trouble hiking, swimming. She even had to stop surfing. She got hit with low blood sugar and tremors, aches, dizziness. And eventually, a test confirmed that she had contracted Lyme disease. Now, she's not sure if it was that tick on her head that gave her Lyme, but what she does know is that she didn't take antibiotics after that bite. Antibiotics would have targeted the culprit. Borrelia burgdorferi, or Borrelia for short. It's a kind of bacteria, and it's wily, insidious, and tough. It has a funny shape, like a corkscrew. Scientists call that shape a spirochete. And like any good bacteria, these spirochetes hunt for the body's vulnerable nooks and crannies.
When it gets into us, we're not entirely sure where it ends up.
That's Dr. Stephen Rich, director of the Laboratory of Medical Zoology and professor of microbiology at UMass Amherst.
Sometimes it's heart tissue, sometimes it's joint tissue. The problem is it's not supposed to be in us, so it causes problems.
As soon as the spirochetes enter the body, they start multiplying. It's warm. They like that. As they multiply, the human body detects the Borrelia and sends out antibodies. But these spirochetes, they're tricky. They're good at slipping under the immune system's radar. To go undercover, they rearrange their outer proteins. Think of it like this. You're at a soccer match. There's a bunch of antagonistic hooligans causing trouble. Security identifies them by their striped jerseys and tries to kick them out. But this crew is sneaky. Some change into different colors, maybe some put on a shirt and tie. Some even hide in the bathroom. Bathroom, in this case, being the heart, the joints, the eyes, etc. For Ryan, the symptoms started in her brain. Fatigue, depression.
Be really foggy, almost like you're just like in this spooky haunted house that you cannot really see too far ahead of you.
The spirochetes hung out in her brain for a while, and then they multiplied. They moved to her heart. She experienced inflammation and an increased heart rate.
Almost as if it was like just gonna like beat out of my chest, like really, really fast.
Then the spirochetes moved on to her joints.
Literally feels like someone's like hammering nails into your joints, like one by one.
Ryan says it feels like her whole body was besieged by Lyme. At this point with Lyme disease, the hooligans, the spirochetes, have overrun the stadium. Help is needed. The security, the immune system, it's doing what it can, but it's just not enough. The immune system needs reinforcements. Reinforcements like antibiotics. So what started as a scuffle with ruffians at a soccer match turns into war. A full-blown battle with soldiers and artillery. The antibiotics? Those are like grenades. Here's Dr. Rich.
You sort of lob them in there, boom, they blow up. They just keep it from growing so that immune system has enough time to get all its resources in place and have an appropriate response. So like a minefield is out there.
The minefield, Ryan's body.
They're just sitting there.
The antibiotics are just sitting there.
Doing their job, you know, blowing up things.
Blowing up the spirochetes.
Until the soldiers can get there and actually do the fighting.
Dr. Rich wants to better understand this battle with Lyme disease. To do that, he and his research team study the bacteria and where we get it from, ticks. In his lab, they pulverize ticks into dust and extract DNA to find out if each is infected. There are still a lot of questions about Lyme disease. Debate rages over whether Lyme is a curable infection or a chronic illness. But what we do know is the tick population is growing every year. More people are getting bitten and more people are getting sick. Ryan McIntyre is taking antibiotics for her Lyme disease now, and she hopes she'll be back surfing again soon. And those ticks, they're still out there, still lurking, harboring Borrelia spirochetes, and waiting for their next blood meal. For WCAI, I'm Robin Miniter.
Robin Miniter is a recent graduate of the Transom Story Workshop. Joining us on the phone now, Dr. Stephen Rich, the very same Stephen Rich that you heard in that piece. He's professor of microbiology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So you've been researching Lyme disease since 1992. How have we seen the prevalence of Lyme disease spread over the past two decades, and what are some of the theories as to why?
Well, one of the things we've seen is a change in the geographic distribution. So where it was once a problem that was restricted to coastal New England and perhaps some pockets in the upper Midwest, it's spread out from those central foci. So it's moved northwestward into the interior of New York State, et cetera, and then it's moved northeastward up into the Maritime Canada area. And even from that upper Midwestern pocket in Wisconsin and Minnesota, we start to see it spread southward and eastward down through the Ohio Valley. So wherever the ticks are, we haven't really seen an increase nor a decrease in the infection rate. But what we have seen is a changing range of where the ticks are, and everywhere the ticks move, they bring the pathogens with them.
You established the Laboratory of Medical Zoology at UMass in 2006 as a research platform to provide information to individuals and communities seeking data about ticks and tick-borne diseases. What kinds of research are you doing on the ticks, and what are some of your findings?
Yeah, we felt that an overlooked piece of the puzzle was we had lots of information about the entomological piece. We knew where the ticks were, and we knew infection rates, and although the surveillance was somewhat spotty, because going into the field and collecting ticks is not the easiest thing. It's labor-intensive, and then you bring them back to the laboratory, and you have to analyze them. The other piece of the puzzle that we had was we knew where people were getting sick, because they report those illnesses to their doctors and their health agencies, et cetera. We felt what was missing was the connection between the two. We wanted to know what was going on with the ticks specifically that bit people, understanding that the ticks that come in the wild may or may not be the ticks that are infecting people. And so we're focusing on that as the critical moment, since it is a tick-borne disease, to figure out what's going on with post-tick bite. How many people are getting sick? How many people are experiencing the spectrum of disease associated with all these different pathogens, which, as the piece said, go beyond just Lyme disease now.
Yeah. So talk about that. What are some of the other, for the black-legged tick, what else could they possibly carry?
For the black-legged tick, there's three big ones. There's Lyme disease, obviously. About 50% of the adult ticks are infected with Lyme disease. Then there's Babesia, which is a malaria-like parasite that can be co-transmitted with the same tick bite. And then a second bacterium, Anaplasma phagocytophilum, which can cause a disease in humans as well. There's a longer list of rarer ones, and by rare I mean usually less than 1% of the ticks that bite people would have things, for example, like Borrelia miyamotoi, which is one of the newer bacteria to become associated with these ticks. There are different types of viruses, for example. There's Powassan virus, which we've spent some time looking at on the Cape. We say that the tick bite is not a single point of entry, but it can represent several different threats.
And then we have, what about dog ticks? Dog ticks don't carry Lyme, but what could they possibly carry?
Dog ticks can be associated with things like Rocky Mountain spotted fever, tularemia. They're not associated with Lyme disease per se, but there may be other Borrelias that are inside them, and you know, we continue to look and keep an open monitoring scheme for those.
And then, of course, we have Lone Star ticks, the new tick in the area, right?
Yeah, so Lone Star ticks in their native range further south, which is Virginia and North Carolina, they are associated with a disease called Ehrlichiosis. We haven't seen Ehrlichiosis in the Cape as the Lone Star ticks are moving in. We don't know if it's just a matter of time whether they bring it and get it established there. There's also a bacterium that's related to Lyme disease called Borrelia lone star eye, named for the lone star tick from which it's collected, that's thought to have caused disease in the past. The current thinking is that it may actually not be such a bad bad actor after all, that it's a bacterium, but it's probably not causing a lot of disease. So the good news is that while lone star ticks are pretty clearly now on the Cape, established on the Cape and Islands, they don't seem to be associated with disease transmission to the extent that deer ticks are.
Yeah, and I think the work you're doing, being able to send in a tick when somebody gets bitten, I know I sent one in last year that I found on my grandson. It's a great service. So, what's the process if somebody wants to send you a tick and find out if it is carrying Lyme or something else? What do people have to do?
So as we sit here today, there's the primary way that people send us ticks is the tick bites. You pull the tick off. You go online and you order what we call a tick report at tickreport.com. You'll get an order number. You write that order number on a plastic baggie, a Ziploc plastic baggie, place the tick inside it, and mail it to the address that's indicated in the order process. We reconcile that order number with the tick when it arrives in the laboratory, and then it makes its way through our queue. We take pictures of it so that we document what it looked like when it arrived with us. Then we do a series of tests, which are very sophisticated modern molecular techniques to detect the DNA or the RNA of the pathogens inside that tick. And within sometimes as few as 12 or up to 72 hours, a maximum of 3 days, we would give those answers back to you. That's the primary way we get ticks, but I'm happy to say that very soon we'll be having some other locations in the state where people will be able to drop the ticks off. So we've done this at UMass for several years. We have an office downstairs, and people will drive as far as Albany and Boston to drop off their ticks. Saves a couple day of mail and gets the ticks in earlier.
So are you getting a good number of ticks every year with this?
Yeah, we see we're expecting between 18 and 20,000 this year.
Wow.
It sort of increases by 25% or 50% every year. So that's what we anticipate from the 14 or 15,000 we saw last year.
So how is this funded? Oop, we've got some technical problems here. All right, let's figure out our issues there. We'll see if we can get that figured out. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll take a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about ticks and Lyme disease. On the phone with us is Dr. Stephen Rich, professor of microbiology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. We had a little bit of a technical problem there. So you were talking about 18,000 to 20,000 ticks. So how is this funded? Who's paying for all this research?
So when we started this in 2006, I'll be honest, we were a little bit sheepish about we had to ask people to pay for the service, and we didn't know if that was the right thing for us to be doing. We're a state university, we're a nonprofit, but we built it basically on the model that had been employed for decades, which is the agricultural extension model. We understood that people want this information. The laboratory is a resource available to folks, and so we offered the service as a fee-for-service. So individuals pay for it. We've actually since partnered with local health agents, and most recently with the State Department of Public Health through a grant from the CDC to offset those costs. But I'm quite convinced that the way to fund this is through a crowdsource model, mm-hmm. because people value it. They get information about their individual risks. And then in aggregate, we get information about what's going on in the whole population. So it's a mixture of state, local, and federal funding, but it always will, I think, the sustainable approach will always include a crowdsource model where people pay some portion of the testing fee.
Now, if you have the ability to expand your research, what area do you think would be most important?
So what we're really realizing now is that critical moment when the tick bites the person, that's the evidence that links that tick bite with illness that's to come. So the spectrum of diseases associated with all those different pathogens, it will be so much easier to understand, or it will be so much more tractable to get some idea of what kind of diseases are associated with those tick bites when we know the tick bite has occurred. So heretofore, the way one would study tick-borne disease is people show up sick in a clinic, and then they might get incorporated into a study based on the evidence that they say they got bitten by a tick. We now have a pedigreed history of people that are exposed to these things or not exposed to these pathogens. And so what we're really excited about is doing some clinical follow-up and epidemiological follow-up on the individuals that have had those exposures so we can see what the range of different diseases that come about when people get bitten by ticks that have one pathogen, multiple pathogens, or in some cases no pathogens. So we know that there are even allergies that are associated with certain tick bites. And so focusing on that critical moment is a research opportunity that we see that is going to be a game changer. Mm-hmm.
Let's bring in Dr. Najim Zaidi. He's an infectious disease specialist at South Coast Health. He's also assistant professor of medicine, clinical infectious disease at Brown University. And he's in studio with us. Good morning.
Hi.
Get a bit closer.
Hi. How you doing?
So, good. So what are the trends that you're seeing in terms of number of cases of Lyme in your practice?
They seem to increase every year, and they're happening earlier and earlier. As people become more adventuresome, I guess, going out in the snow earlier in spring. The other thing is that local people seem to know what are the high tick areas. Everybody knows somebody who got a specific disease in a specific area. Like, for instance, where I practice, a lot of times, Acushnet, Tiverton, Rhode Island, are areas where it seems that if you go out into the woods, you will get disease. The other thing is ticks like certain areas with leaves, humid trees, tall grass. And, you know, by studying the disease, I mean, it was discovered in 10 to 15-year-old boys where they seem to go, they seem to attract a lot of attention from the ticks. So it's behavior of how these animals quest, who doesn't look for them, who doesn't shower, I guess, does drive the disease. The other thing is that it is important that you could get more than one disease from the tick, but there are other patterns, like, for instance, there was a year in which we were seeing a lot of 70-year-olds getting babesiosis, and which they tend to do, but it seemed to be only babesiosis that they're getting in a specific area. Anaplasmosis would be another one that we would get to in a specific area for a specific tick. Anyways, the local population seems to know the high tick areas.
So let's talk about the symptoms of Lyme, because you know, flu-like symptoms, what, I mean, there could be a lot of things, right?
That is correct. The other thing, I mean, what was alluded to earlier is not that some people have more symptoms and some others do not. Some people may be carrying subclinical, they never suffer from it. Some people may have immunity. But generally, people who do seem to get the disease do get it within the next couple of weeks of a tick bite. About only 4 out of 10 recall that tick bite, so they may not even know they have the disease. And then they do have aches and pains and flu. I don't know whether you've actually suffered from the flu, but it's you feel pretty sick. So there could be high fevers. They could be a certain part of the day. There would be definitely muscle aches and joint aches, sometimes one joint more than the other, in the early stages of the disease. And then as the disease goes on, you may recover from this phase or have less symptoms. And then it starts to, as the disease spreads from skin to general blood, and then it settles in nervous tissue, then there a second set of symptoms seems to occur. And some people do get very severe headaches, children especially. So if you have a child who's adventuresome and is having headaches that are not going away associated with early fevers, you know, they might have Lyme disease.
Check it out. Yeah. All right. So, what do you do if you find a tick embedded in your body?
You remove it. Mm-hmm. And there are like ways of doing it where it's near the skin. There's tweezers that you could remove it with and try to preserve the tick body. You could magnify it with your phone. Send picture to somebody who knows how to identify a tick, or you could compare those pictures with online pictures and figure out which kind of a tick it is.
We'll bring Dr. Rich back in here. When we're removing the tick, you want as much of the tick as possible, right?
Ideally, and I'd emphasize that the important thing is to get the tick off as quickly as possible, because as soon as the tick is off, even if a part is broken off, the disease transmission cycle, or the pathogen transmission cycle, is interrupted. It's stopped.
Yeah, and you want to be careful. You don't want to squeeze the stomach, right? Because you can squeeze that stuff right into you, right?
That's actually a myth. So
it's
there's blocks inside the pharynx of the tick, or the tube that it feeds through, that don't allow things to come out of the tick when you squeeze it.
We want
people to not be worried about grabbing hold of it and getting it off as quick as they can. Don't use dish soap or nail polish or any of those remedies.
Just get it out. Okay.
But once it's out, you can use dish soap or whatever soap if you have, wash it up. Yeah. Yes.
So let's say that we send this tick off and it comes back positive for Lyme. Am I going to run to your office? What do I do?
Well, first of all, I would say that the tick testing I would encourage only if you're really interested and in specialized labs like Dr. Rich. But we get like hair and insects and other things which are crushed remnants of God knows what. So not all labs are equipped to deal with this identification or have the resources. So they cannot be just sent to, say, mm-hmm. any South Coast lab or any other lab that is present, or a commercial lab, God forbid, because there are players out there that will say, hey, we identified that as a tick and you have Lyme disease. And they mm-hmm. can't do that just by looking at that. So right. that's number one. Number two, if you have identified the correct tick and you feel that it was there for at least a couple of days, 3 days, 36 hours, then there is advocacy for taking a loading dose of doxycycline, which is one of the drugs we give for treatment of Lyme disease, but only one dose. Mm-hmm. And so there's ways of they're doing that, and that is becoming more and more accepted as a safe drug, even to use in children mm-hmm. and in pregnancy.
So what about the testing to find out if you have Lyme? How is it a blood test?
First of all, there is no blood test that will that will test it early. So if you have the pathogen in your blood, there is no test that you can do immediately to find out whether it's going to give you Lyme disease or not, or the fact that you're going to get Lyme disease. However, if you start having symptoms, which could be 10 or 14 days after the tick bite, this is not the time to get a blood test. It takes a few weeks for the antibodies to develop. The disease itself and the fact of removal of the tick and the fact that you live in a specific area that has Lyme disease is more likely to get you treated rather than trying to look for the diagnosis, because that strays it off into another direction. Yeah.
So what are the treatment protocols for babesiosis, anaplasmosis, Rocky Mountain spot fever?
Well, we're lucky. So in the respect that a very effective drug, which is available with physicians, doxycycline, does treat three of the pathogens that are transmitted by the tick. So definitely the doxycycline will get Lyme disease, and it treats anaplasmosis. It does not treat babesia, but in the younger, immunocompetent people who have strong immune systems, most of us who are not aged above 60 or 70, will have that babesia would be a mild disease and it'll be slower. And there's a different treatment for that, azithromycin and etoboquine.
We have yet to develop a vaccine for Lyme disease. There was one several years ago. It was taken off the market after some people developed adverse side effects. There's a company in Austria which will be starting phase 2 study of Lyme vaccine, but that could take, 3 to 5 years or more. So what's been the challenge here? Why is it so challenging?
I think you kind of outlined the challenge. All vaccines have, when you give the vaccine, skin irritation and pain. All vaccines are not 100% effective. When we say we have yet to develop a Lyme vaccine, no, we developed it and we did pretty good with it. It just didn't sell. And then there was lots of fears about vaccines that came into force at that particular time. There was risk of litigation in the United States. So all of those commercial problems, low sales, kind of drove it off the market. It was about 60% effective. No one knows how long it was effective. So we do need to keep looking and to get better vaccines with less side effects, hopefully. People have to live with whether they want Lyme disease or a vaccine. Yeah. Yeah.
So as an infectious disease doctor, what unanswered questions do you have about Lyme? And is there a particular research or study area that you'd like to see that you think would help diagnose?
So I think that there is medical mistrust, just like with syphilis. This is another spirochete cousin. And it was the way Lyme was discovered. It was through medical advocacy. It was a couple of mothers in Connecticut who pushed for an alternative diagnosis to they were being told that the joint disease was some kind of rheumatological problem. So there is medical mistrust. The lab testing, as you know, doesn't work in the early part of the disease. It does work quite well later. And then once your antibodies are positive, they remain positive for life. So what I would like, but there is a certain subset of patients that do have symptoms persistent after treatment. So that needs a lot of research. We need to allay the fears about that. We need to be able to treat that better so that those people come back and say, hey, we did well with a particular set of treatment. There is also a lot of misinformation about the disease. The problem with scientific literature, which is evidence-based, is that and scientific investigation is you have to have had Lyme disease with evidence of it or a pretty good story. Tick and yeah. the disease. And once you got treated, and if you have persistent symptoms, then you have what's post Lyme disease treatment symptoms, and we would try to work on what's causing them. But there is another set of population that has Lyme disease by exclusion. Well, you don't have anything else, therefore you have Lyme disease. And that particular population who never experienced the pathogen or a tick bite should not be told that they have Lyme disease based on spurious testing or commercial labs. And then these are being kind of like people want to help them. And so they're being given medications which have proven track record with Lyme disease or not for longer periods of time than they should. And that has not helped. So there is a lot of fear, mistrust, alternative diagnoses, commercialism impacting this. And I would like more research into that.
All right. We're discussing Lyme and other tick-borne illnesses this hour. Now joining us on the phone is Dr. Sam Donta. He's a retired infectious disease doctor from Falmouth, who was recently named to the Tick-Borne Disease Working Group, charged with advising the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services on the future direction of tick disease treatment and research. Dr. Donta, welcome.
Thank you.
So if you spent decades on the front lines treating patients with Lyme, what trends have you seen in terms of the number and severity of Lyme cases over the course of your career?
That's hard to pin down because there's been increasing awareness of the possibility that Lyme disease is causing a number of otherwise ill-defined clinical situations. So I don't really know whether the incidence of Lyme disease is really increasing or there's more awareness. However, it's enough that's there of reported cases and of probable cases that it's here for the foreseeable future. Yeah. Like any epidemic, one hopes that at some point it will begin to tail off. But for now, we face the challenges that have already been outlined about diagnosis and treatment.
Now, the CDC recommends for treatment of Lyme 14 to 21 days of antibiotics. Describe your approach to treatment of a patient who's experiencing symptoms of Lyme, and under what circumstances would you prescribe long-term antibiotics?
Well, I think the easiest one to deal with is early Lyme disease. That is disease that's caught between in the first several weeks. And the information that's out there is pretty good that at least 2 weeks, but I think if you look at the evidence, and Dr. Maloney out of Minnesota has looked at this very hard, has pointed out how that it's safer if the person continues to have symptoms, not to just stop after 2 weeks, but to go for an additional 1 to 2 weeks. So depending on the severity of the illness, and like any other infectious disease, you might have a milder form or you might have a more severe form. So I think the clinical situation will dictate for how long. But early on, I think probably 3 to 4 weeks of treatment in early disease. Once the infection has been set for a longer period of time, it is unknown whether one should treat and with which medications one should treat for a sufficient period of time. And because we do not have any tests that can tell us the infection is gone or is still there, one relies on clinical judgment. And currently, the trials that have been done on Lyme disease have been unsuccessful as far as the treatments that have been used over a period of 3 months. There have been some flaws in the design. So my experience over the years, and this might contrast with one of the earlier comments, is that if a person has had Lyme disease and has relapsing symptoms, that if you use, and this is pharmacologically based, especially on my experience over the years with pharmacology and molecular medicine, infectious diseases, with appropriate antibiotic for a longer period of time, one can get successful results. but formal studies of the regimens that we've used have not been done. So we're left with, let's say, observational evidence, which can be very good, but nonetheless might not be convincing to some people.
What do you hope to accomplish in your new post to the Tick-Borne Disease Working Group, which is charged with advising the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services on the future direction of tick disease treatment and research? What are you hoping to accomplish?
Well, this first round of meetings resulted in recommendations to the which are still being drafted in terms of the writing to the Secretary of HHS that we need more research into finding more direct detection tests. Could we find a way to better know that the infection is still there or not there? We may never be able to do that, but we need to at least address that particular issue. I think the important recommendation that there is persisting Lyme disease and the accumulating evidence is that it is due to infectious cause, although there are still people who wonder about it, and there are still regimens, antibiotic regimens, and perhaps other regimens that need to be either acknowledged or discovered to help these people in addition to symptomatic treatment. So the draft report that will go to the HHS basically recommends that more research needs to be devoted, especially to understanding the pathogenesis, that is, how does the infection manifest itself, and over a period of time, how do the bacteria evade the immune response? Are they in privileged sites where the immune system can't get to it, or that even antibiotics might not be able to get to it? Do these bacteria have antibiotic tolerance, as it's called? That is, that they're able to take a hit, if you will, or they'd be able to become quiet during the period that they're exposed to the antibiotic. They don't really become truly resistant to the antibiotic, but they're able to resist. And some research in other areas of bacteriology and infectious diseases are being helpful as well. But I think this is a real opportunity that these bacteria provide models for other infectious in addition to Lyme disease, and we need to have a quantum leap in research funding in this area.
Dr. Zaidi, you're nodding your head.
I agree with a lot of what Dr. Danta is saying. We do need more research. I also feel that we do not need to forge a new path for that research. There are antibiotic therapy was the original chemotherapy. The term chemotherapy was basically, they meant antibiotics. There is a duration with every chemotherapy because it's toxic to the body. There are dangers associated with giving specific antibiotics for a long time. It alters our biome, which makes us prone to other diseases. Finally, if we want to experiment on a specific person who has a disease with a longer course of antibiotics, why don't we do it like cancer researchers, which they enroll them in trials, often double blind, and then see what happens. And this way we will capture all of the people that do not seem to have resolving symptoms, and then we could do specific voluntary research on them in which they enroll, and then we try to figure out which drug helps them or whether longer-term antibiotics may help them or not. But so far, most of the research, however flawed that has been done, doesn't show that prolonging antibiotics helps in these cases.
Well, I'll have to disagree with the point that the emphasis is being made is that further antibiotic treatment may be more toxic and may not benefit. It's true that certain antibiotics are more toxic than others. Tetracycline, for example, that we've used over the last 30 years for periods of time up to a year or more, has not resulted in any toxicity. And the alternate regimen that we've used, combining one of the erythromycin-type antibiotics with another agent that alters the intracellular or the milieu, the acidic milieu pH, has allowed patients to resolve these symptoms. And again, I said that these are observational studies. I think it would be good if there could be collaborative groups that can do these studies, because double-blinding people to take treatments over a year to 2 years is not going to be easy to do or be successful. So I think we're either going to be stuck saying, I have nothing further to offer you, or that according to certain observational studies, it seems like it's being helpful. So one of the recommendations going to HHS is that groups are formed of people who have best practices or who have experience to form collaborative groups. So I'm in agreement there that that may be the way to begin to provide studies that are somewhat blinded, although I think it's going to be difficult. This is a really challenging area.
Dr. Sam Danta, retired infectious disease doctor, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate your time this morning, and we will talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about ticks and the diseases they carry. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. In studio with us is Dr. Najim Zaidi. He is an infectious disease specialist at South Coast Health and assistant professor of medicine, clinical infectious disease at Brown University. On the phone, we have Dr. Stephen Risch, who is professor of microbiology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And also joining us in studio is Dr. David Crandell. He is assistant professor in the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at the Harvard Medical School and the Clinical Director for the Dean Center for Tick-Borne Illness at Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. Welcome.
Good morning.
So tell us more about the mission of the Dean Center and some of the services offered.
Well, the Dean Center at Spalding was formed just a little over 3 years ago based on a direct observation of a clinical need that there was a patient population that was basically unserved. Whether you believe in the diagnosis of chronic or persistent Lyme, there was a subset of individuals who were presenting what we define as post-Lyme disease treatment syndrome. And they would have a various degree of symptoms, but were clearly in need of services. This is a unique service. It's we've tried to start something new. This is not a typical program associated with the Department of Physical Medicine or a rehab facility. But because of direct personal experience through members of our founding staff, we felt it was a real need. I've been in clinical practice over 25 years, and it reminded me back to when I was a resident during the early stages of the HIV and AIDS crisis, where people were presenting with vague neurological conditions. And unfortunately, a number of the medical community basically decided that they would not step up to treat those people. So, you know, with that historical basis, and again, with an infectious disease, we felt we were uniquely positioned to provide some services to this population.
So what are some of the commonalities of your patient's stories or symptoms?
Well, if you'd asked me 3 years ago, I would have said it was going to be very straightforward. At this point, I would tell you that it's really there's a very wide clinical spectrum. If you sort of lump the basic complaints or symptoms that the patients seem to describe, they come into three basic areas. They obviously focus on pain, but there's different subsets of that. That can be, you know, specific joint pain, but muscle aches. There's also people go on to have significant nerve-related pain. The second major symptom category is fatigue, and sometimes this can be significantly disabling to the point where people have a hard time, you know, getting through their day, functioning as a parent or as a coworker. And then the last one, which was mentioned earlier in your presentation piece, is somebody who presents with intermittent encephalopathy, where they actually have brain fog, where they have problems with memory, speed of thinking, processing. People, somebody who typically would know their way around Woods Hole here, even with GPS, sometimes could not find the way to the ferry dock.
Yeah, I can see that, you know, when you have this going on and the anxiety or the depression that would go along with that, you know, constant fatigue or some of these symptoms that you're talking about, would just getting that diagnosis help some of that, you know, depression and anxiety that they're going through?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes giving the condition a label sometimes gives some people some peace of mind. Literally, the first time I would sit down and talk to people, sometimes will take an hour, sometimes 2 hours, just to review how they presented to this point. Mm-hmm. There is some validation in that concept of spending some time with some patients, and then clearly trying to work through, you know, what are there clearly issues. We feel that, you know, despite the controversy over short and long-term antibiotics, there's a role for a more holistic approach or rehabilitation approach, looking at the person. And there are some techniques that we use with other patient populations. Again, I talked about the HIV patient population, but also patients with fibromyalgia or other chronic disabling conditions.
Let's talk to Fritz, who's calling from Kitiewit. Hi, Fritz.
Hello. I got hit with a deer tick earlier this spring, and I had the full bullseye. I removed the tick. I sent it into Amherst and got it tested, and they said they did confirm it was a deer tick, but they didn't find any Lyme in it. Mm. But I'm wondering, how did I get the full bullseye pattern if it wasn't an infectious tick?
Who wants to take that?
I can take that.
Okay.
So
a little bit closer to the mic.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I can take that. And so I feel that you may have found a tick, but it might not have been the tick that bit you. There could have been other ones, smaller ones, that you may have missed.
No, it was in the middle of the bullseye.
It was in the middle of the bullseye. Or they might have missed. No test is 100%. Mm-hmm. So even though they do a highly sensitive test, it's quite possible from you salvaging the tick, transporting it to them, that it might have. You have the disease. You had the bullseye, so I feel. The other thing I would say is that sometimes the bullseye could be misleading. The one that the tick gives you takes about a few days to expand, and it becomes bigger and bigger till it's so big that it's faded away and you can hardly see it. And that takes, the process takes about a week or a few more days. If you have an insect bite, any insect bite, it will also give you a sort of a bullseye, slightly raised, slightly itchy, and that goes away after a couple of days, like mosquito bites do. So some ticks might elicit that particular type of bite. The way to tell is if it goes away faster, it's kind of like an allergic histamine. There's a mm-hmm. chemical that's released reaction. And a lot of times, if you take Benadryl, which is a over-the-counter available antihistamine, or use it topically, and the rash goes away, it was probably not the Lyme disease bullseye. It was just skin irritation.
Dr. Rich, do you want to chime in?
Yeah, I just want to emphasize also that the bullseye rash has several characteristics, including the fact that it expands. So that's the spirochetes migrating through the skin. And so it has open areas that are not, that are clear. And so there's very often a good-sized rash that's associated with tick bite, as Dr. Zaidi pointed out. Bullseye rash diagnosed by your physician?
No, but yeah. I called my physician and he gave me a prescription of doxycycline, which I took immediately, because getting it tested takes another week, right?
A couple more weeks. But so there you go. It could be very likely. So the doc never saw the rash or confirmed that it was an erythema migrans?
But there was a tick in the middle of this.
Yep.
That was,
so people get reactions. I think it's important for listeners to understand that, as Dr. Zaidi pointed out, that ticks have their own chemistries. They have salivary proteins that cause irritation at the site of the wound, and they will lead to a redness or a rash. And depending on how sensitive you are to those compounds, that rash may be bigger or smaller. I happen to be pretty sensitive to ticks. They don't even to the extent that they don't bite me very much. I've seen people that have been bitten by ticks that will get a 2-inch diameter rash. It's not expanding. It goes away after a short period of time without antibiotic treatment, and there are no other symptoms.
All right. Thank you for the call, Fritz. Rebecca from Brewster writes, I've heard that permethrin is the number one best way to protect yourself, but it's very labor-intensive to spray each and every item of clothing in my family's wardrobe. I'm wondering why there isn't a program to just spray permethrin all over the areas that have high amounts of ticks. Is there some sort of environmental concern about permethrin? Also, are there any places you can send clothing to be laundered in permethrin in return so you don't have to buy it that way? Go ahead.
Yeah, I can answer that very well. And I've used permethrin for years. First of all, you know, it's a plant-derived product. I don't think there's a huge environmental concern unless you're going to spray large areas. But how I handle clothes is very practical. If those are the ones that they're going to wear in the woods, I will isolate those. And then you put them on the floor with, like, garbage bags under them or plastic, and then you spray all of them. And then you flip them and you spray the other side. And if you're really, you can spray insides and wring them out.
But
and
don't
stuff.
Spray it on your skin.
No, I mean it's okay. It's not that deadly. Yeah. But having said that, once those clothes, those particular clothes, have been treated, they're done. Yeah, you could probably wear them through the entire summer because they can go through several washes. Products up to 15 washes,
wow.
20.
Okay.
So they're done for the summer. So that's one. The second thing is this DEET. If you're going to a high intensity tick area, you can apply that to the skin, and that could get a little irritating. The coolest thing with the DEET you could do, it, even though it doesn't survive a wash, is that you apply it to your skin and then you kind of accidentally spray it on the clothes too. So the ticks have a double protection.
Dr. Rich, were you trying to chime in here?
Yeah, I just want to emphasize that permethrin is actually a synthetic derivative of a naturally occurring plant compound.
That's
not,
correct.
Not from plants derived.
Okay.
And I think the question was about environmental risk. So while it's great to have it on your pants, and we really reinforce the message, there are consequences of spraying it into the environment, into yards, into perimeters. For example, it kills virtually every insect that it comes in contact with. So pollinators, for example, can be affected with it. So it's not without consequence when it's taken off clothing and put into the environment.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dr. Crandall.
You can send your clothes into a company called Insect Shield, and they'll treat it all for you.
Oh.
You can also get them on Markdown at TJ Maxx, you can buy these products for retail as well.
So how does the Dean Center work with primary care physicians in treating Lyme?
Well, again, it's we work in a coordinated team approach, just like we work with other patients. So we'll get a referral from an internal medicine, infectious disease physician. So again, we're evaluating the patients and seeing what type of services that we can add as a way to help manage their symptoms. And in rehab medicine, people have heard of the TBI, or traumatic brain injury, but we just recoined that term as the new TBI is tick-borne impairment.
Mm.
The fact that people who have had experience with vector disease can also have impairment. And we're working on combination of therapies, whether it be physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech-language pathology for those with cognitive issues, to really take that person and try to limit their impairment to avoid a chronic disabling condition.
I really appreciate physiatrists and physical therapy, because I feel that they physiatry services specifically not only address and can take care of a lot of the chronic manifestations of post-treatment Lyme disease, but also if they have something else, you get function out, and that very might limit their debility. So I feel that if you were looking for a specific treatment that is not long-term antibiotic or experimental, this actually has evidence and it works.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah. Real quick, let's see what Janet from Tisbury has to say. Janet, you got less than a minute.
Oh God! I don't know if I can do that. I have Lyme disease. I went to the hospital on Saturday, and they performed all kinds of tests on me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what half of them are.
Yeah. Well, we kind of did talk about the testing, and you're right. It's complicated. But we should also mention that there are Lyme support groups that meet on the Cape, and I don't know if hopefully there's some on the islands as well. We'll have links with more information about those groups, how to send in a tick for testing, and the services offered at the Dean Center for Tick-Borne Illnesses at our website, capeandislands.org. I want to thank my guest this morning, Dr. Stephen Risch, Professor of Microbiology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, Dr. Najim Zaidi, who's an infectious disease specialist at South Coast Health and assistant professor of medicine and clinical infectious disease at Brown University, Dr. David Crandall, who is the director of the Dean Center for Tick-Borne Illness at Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital, also assistant professor in the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at the Harvard Medical School. Thank you all for being part here today. Appreciate it. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.